Wally, one thing missing from your expert analysis there is the absolute panic that this guy must have experienced when he realized exactly what had happened and how few options he had. I mean, let's throw that into the fix. I mean, because here's a guy now all of a sudden that has just been really slammed over the head with a baseball bat.
You bet. And if it's not something that he has thought about and pre-planned before he got in this position, it's just an overload. It would just so preoccupy one, and I think could easily distract big time from your flying.
So how do you recapture control of a situation that you've just absolutely lost control of?
Well, I think, as I said in the beginning, you need to, particularly given the unique nature of this flight, going into mountainous terrain with only GPS available for navigation, you really need to give a lot of thought to what options do I have if this GPS either fails in the airplane or the satellite system fails me. And doing that early on, at least you've got some options, perhaps pre-tuned some radios. You've already got a plan in your mind. If you haven't given that any thought, as you approach the final approach fix, you're a pretty busy person, and it's a little late to start making up plans at that time.
And GPS just works. I mean, we everyone uses it, and it works. So when we do our what if, it's not one of the programs we divert back to. So, you're right. If we plan this out, no big deal. But when you haven't planned it out, how do you make up for all that, that lost knowledge that, would have been nice if you had done it, a half hour or 2 hours ago?
Well, you're right. We get so accustomed to it working, sort of like that pre-flight when we never find anything wrong. The day there is something wrong, we miss it. And we are just so accustomed to GPS being reliable and working all the time, but we have to realize it's not going to work all the time, and we have to consider that.
But part of our situational awareness, okay, entails if we're going to an airport and we know that it's only got a GPS approach, yes, we become very complacent in checking our GPS NOTAMs and checking RAIM. Yes, we don't do it. Oh, it's WAS-enabled. We don't need to check the RAIM. It'll tell us that it's not available. And as it did here at the very worst moment, said, but if you're really paying attention and you know you're going to an airport that only has a GPS approach, I would think it would behoove any pilot to not only check the NOTAMs for it, to check the RAIMs to see if GPS might go out, but also to have belt and suspenders and be backed up for everything else. And I'll address that a little later.
Well, Doug, one thing I really like what you said is this concept of situational awareness. And we really, I push that as just such a key element to flying. Where am I and what around me what might hurt me? Well, where am I and what around me might hurt me, doesn't include GPS, but in this case, it better and is the essence of the whole thing, because that one element, puts you, absolutely behind the eight ball, Bob.
What occurs to me, Bob, is altitude is your friend. A surprise event like this, climb. First reaction should be get that airplane climbing away from the ground.
And see, that's an important instinct, I think, that we really have to get out there, because in a void, we need a first step. We need a starting point. And that's why, Wally, one of the things that leaped out from your analysis was prioritizing, and that kind of brings that into play. In a dangerous situation, especially when terrain's in, climb, and then everything starts looking a little bit better. So a first step in many, many, many situations, great. From you reaching into that bag of tools, that's a good one. John?
I got to be honest. My first take on this when we were drafting this, the first time I read it, was like, the airport's straight ahead. We know the heading that the final approach is going to be. It's only a couple hundred feet straight ahead. Why not just keep going and hope that the thing comes back, or you can just dead reckon a little bit? The weather's not that bad. I mean, literally, that was my first impression or my first reaction. And then the more you think about it, you realize how stupid it is. But the temptation, I think, would be tremendous. You're this close to the airport, and it's only a few hundred feet down, and you just got to go straight ahead a little bit, and you're there. I say that sucker right in is so strong. That was my first reaction until I started thinking about it.
There's one word that you used, though, in there. I hope.
Yeah, yeah.
And hope has no place in aviation.
Exactly. But I'm just saying that was my first reaction or first instinct, until you start thinking about it.
I think that a lowlander or flatlander might take that position.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll tell you, the first time I went into Jackson Hole, did an ILS, and it was solid IFR. We broke out at about 700 or 800 feet, landed. I think we debarked the passengers and left. Next time I went to Jackson Hole was clear VFR, and I said, holy cow. You
know? Bring back those clouds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I think
you've got to consider that.
Temptation is strong to say, I just descend a few hundred feet and I'm going to break out. And, you know, pilots, we should be more like the birds. You know, when a bird is frightened, they fly away. When pilots are frightened, we go to the ground.
Yes.
And if
yes.
we can just break out of these clouds, we'll be okay. And that's how they wind up hitting
and
rocks.
And we get suckered in by the occasional glimpses of the ground straight down and everything. That's why I thought the temptation was really strong.
Yeah, and there's another concern there too, which was, well, let's suppose you did descend. Now you got below the clouds. Now you're at the airport. Now what?
Yeah.
Because you can't really – I mean, leaving this airport, it turns out there is a departure procedure that doesn't require GPS. So there is something you could fly. But just getting out of the airport becomes an issue, especially if it was like a mechanical thing where you're like, oh, well, I can finish the approach. And now it's like, well, great. But you're stuck in the middle of nowhere.
Well, still better to be stuck on the ground, you know, wishing you were in the air than the other way around.
Right, but choosing between aborting the approach and getting back in the system and going back to a better airport versus, oh, I can finish this and, well, great, now I've just dug myself into a different hole.
And a concept that keeps coming back is this discipline, pilot discipline, recognizing, you know, the consequences of following your instincts, you know, versus, you know, really taking that extra second to realize, yeah, that is drawing me down, but that's just dead wrong. And discipline is just a key word, you know, so often in all of our flying that we just have to, you know, keep that, make sure that's part of our foundation.
Yeah. Well, and also we've talked a lot around this table about planning for an approach. And here's one of those places where if you were going in IFR and you're planning to come out IFR, well, then you should have briefed the departure procedure out of there. And as it turns out, if you look at the departure procedure here, that's another option that we didn't sort of specifically say, but you're basically flying right into the departure procedure for the opposite runway, and it even gives you a radial off of a nearby VOR that you can intercept and fly that you know is then a safe climb out radial. So that's one of those things, like I had piece of information I had planned for X that if I knew and it was queued up in my mind, oh, wait, I know I have that as well. So as I start turning, well, which VOR am I going to go to? Oh, well, it's Dove Creek, and it's right there, and it's radial. I don't have it right in front of me, a 223. There you go. See, that's the good thing about having it written down somewhere, right? So I wouldn't have intercepted the wrong one. But nonetheless, like there is a procedure you could grab from a completely other part of your planning that was immediately applicable and is a known safe.
You mentioned planning, though. Would not part of your pre-flight planning, you know you're going to this airport, ideally to land, and then take off to go back to meet your family at Farmington. One would think that one had already looked at that.
Right.
Okay. Another aspect of this, though, that I try to teach all my clients is belt and suspenders. And for me, it's just like – it's not if the engine quits. It's when the engine quits. It's not if the GPS will fail. It's when the GPS fails. And in this equipment, this pilot could have easily had four different VOR frequencies tuned. If I was flying this, I certainly would have been tracking off of Dove Creek. Back in the day, I learned, you know, GPSs go perfectly straight. I learned before we had GPS, before we had Loran, it was all needles. And I constantly use cross radials. And if you're flying an airplane that has bearing pointers, so many pilots are flying G1000, 500, 600 Aspen, and they never turn the bearing pointers on. They're on in my airplane all the time and constantly tuning these. So the option to climb and divert to any one of these VORs, Dove Creek is probably the best because we see that 9,000 feet is going to have us safe.
It's interesting what you say about bearing pointers too. I mean, that's one of those wonderful things. And it's one of the places where we don't think about all the things tied to a GPS, and this gets to systems. So if I've got my bearing pointers up, you know, they're showing me relatively where a VOR is. But you could say, well, I don't need that because I've got a moving map the size of Kentucky sitting there in the panel. So I don't need the bearing pointer. I can just see where the VOR is. But if I lose GPS, I lose the moving map too. And people don't think about that. Or if I lose GPS, I lose my weather because it can't locate me. I lose my traffic because it doesn't know, you know, my relative position. There are all these things that are tied to the GPS system. Storm scopes will go out. So you can lose one system and it'll take down this herd of others that go along with it. You were talking about a NOTAM. If you're in a Phenom 300, you lose GPS. You could lose the flight augmentation system.
Yeah.
You know, we're so dependent on it now. Everywhere, and so it permeates all these other systems.
And the flip side of that is understanding all these messages. If you look in the back of a Garmin manual, which is, you know, probably about 4 pounds of paper in the seat back pocket of every airplane, there's 100 pages of error messages and troubleshooting stuff. Do you know what – I mean, have you ever looked at them? Do you know what all those error messages mean? Some of them may be benign. Some of them may be you know, a minor problem. What do you have left, and what can you still do on? You know, you had a story about your GS
right.
enunciation.
That, we were talking about that over our lunch. That and I went and looked up the code here. I was in a Columbia 400 with a friend. We're on an ILS. We've just begun the descent, and we get a message on one of his 430s that says G/S is not responding. Now we had good needles, no flags on the HSI. G/S glide slope, maybe. Have you seen that message before? I've never seen it before. And so we split duties. He tuned the second GPS to the ILS, right? So this is a belt and suspenders. We didn't have the second one set up for the approach. Meanwhile, I grabbed the manual out of the back of the seat pocket and was flipping through, you know, section 11, and I called it up here. So this is what I read while we're descending on the ILS. G/S is not responding. Internal system-to-system communication between the main processor and the glide slope receiver has failed. Operational status of the glide slope receiver is unknown, and the unit should be returned to your Garmin dealer for service. I'm on approach! But then you go, but wait, that doesn't answer my most important question.
Can I still use it?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It says that the internally a message has failed, but I don't have a flag. I should be getting a flag. So does it work? Does it not work? And we ended up just saying, forget it. We're going down, and we did the localizer approach and got out below the clouds.
Yeah.
Even the error messages that you brought up, Wally, about, you know, if we had seen a white airplane on the moving map, we can still fly the missed approach. There comes a point where we've learned, you know, this equivalent of a nav flag for GPS approach is the little enunciation. I should see LPV or LNAV or whatever it happens to be for this approach, right? And here in the manual it says, if the GPS cannot meet even non-precision HAL limits, the unit will send a message to the pilot to abort the approach, quote, abort approach, loss of navigation. That is, in fact, what a 430-530 will tell you, even though – it says right after that, the unit will revert to terminal limits to support navigation. So you still can navigate, but to navigation to the missed approach point when the message is acknowledged. So you could have a situation at this approach where it didn't have integrity. You got a message that said abort approach, loss of navigation, but you can have GPS navigation, but not until you acknowledge that message with the message button. How many people have read that through their manuals?
I
admit I hadn't until we had gone through this whole scenario and set everything up.
We need to have a Philadelphia lawyer in the back seat so he can not only read that stuff but tell us what it means.
Well, it's all in the manual because I need it legally there, but that doesn't mean, you know, that it's going to be read by them.
Yeah, and there are a lot of these little corner cases and things that show up in approaches. You know, here's another one I had to call Garmin about, and I'll put it out there because in case this ever happens to anyone else. So you have an approach that you've loaded that has LPV-only minimums. The approach plate says LPV, and there's no LNAV. Now, we know the GPS receiver, if it can't meet WAS minimums, will downgrade, if it can, to LNAV. Question, does the Garmin 430, 530, 650 know that on this particular approach there is not an option to downgrade to LNAV? Or will it go to LNAV, leaving you thinking, oh, wait, LNAV minimums on this approach. Wait, this one's only LPV. So which approach can I use? How does that work? Right? Does it have that piece of information?
I'll bet it does not.
That was my bet, too. Turns out it does.
Really?
Yeah, it actually does. They have in the database, it knows whether it has the option to downgrade to LNAV. And if it can't do LPV, it'll tell you to miss the approach. It'll jump straight ahead. So there are all these weird little corner cases that could come up that, you know, hopefully somebody's thought of. In that case, they have. Or maybe they haven't, and you're the first person who ran into that situation, especially if we end up with new approach designs, which are coming out while we speak.
But is it really realistic, you know, to know all those error messages and what they do and what they don't do for you?
That's why you need.
That's why you go back to the belt and suspenders.
And also, when things aren't going well, you go up rather than going down.
Yeah, altitude is your friend.
Just as Bob said, yeah, there's nothing as useless as altitude above you.
And, you know, one of the things we keep coming back to here, I think, is that how important is realistic training, you know, and simulating these failures so that you've seen them before. The first time you see it is not in the real world with your son sitting next to you. It's when you have a flight instructor along and lots of options. So, you know, realistic training and being prepared for this kind of thing. And the first time you see it is not, you know, when, you know, it's too late.
As I mentioned to some of you the other day, I had a client who's flown with me for years with a G-36 Bonanza. And one day we were up in Maine in Bangor, and the highest ceilings were 300 feet. And I said, guess what? We're going to file slant alpha this morning. And he had never flown that way before. And he was thrilled to do that training to realize I don't really need the GPS. I can navigate without it.
And that's the kind of stuff that you can do in an IPC, you can go out with – you just – all you need is a safety pilot or something and do a bunch of what-ifs.
Absolutely. And so often we become complacent and just want to follow that magenta line, go perfectly straight.
Or you get complacent in the training. You know, you go out and you do three approaches, one circle to land, sign off, done. Well, how about doing something like that that explores some of the lesser-known failures that you might have?
I've read of GPS failures because you can buy a GPS jammer online on eBay for like $35.
Do we want to go there?
I don't want to go there, but truckers do buy these, and truckers do use these, and truckers have shut down GPS approaches using that equipment.
Let's talk about charts and maps a little bit. Before we all got these fancy iPad gadgets, did you all carry sectional charts as well as your IFR low altitude charts when you flew around?
Of course.
Of course. Well, I did sometimes.
Sometimes they were up to date, right?
Yeah.
Well, luckily the mountains don't move that often.
Right. And sometimes they were actually accessible, too. They weren't in the back seat.
And can you imagine, you know, taking accordion lessons to get those things out and back together when you're flying in mountainous terrain. So isn't it a great advantage to have an electronic iPad or something so that you can flip quickly from IFR low altitude to VFR chart to get a quick look at terrain clearance in this case?
And just one more crutch that kind of sucks us in, you know, radar contact. I mean, when we're operating in a non-radar environment, and boy, how much of the time are we in a radar environment? So we get really spoiled, and it's really easy to give up, you know, some of your situational awareness when you're in that mode, and then all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, it's just me out here. Just me.
Yeah, ATC can do nothing for you here.
No, exactly. So it's just, you know, once again, having a plan, you know, training for this kind of situation. Doug, you pointed that out, but I just think that we need to have realistic training. We talked earlier about, oh, I got my three approaches. I got my three, you know, I got this. You know, well, we can meet the minimums, but that's not preparing you to meet the real tough situation when it's most inadvertent.